Interview with Bert Waits, July 4th, 1979.
Yes, Bert, I was going to ask, was the mental hospital service your first job, or did you work elsewhere?
Oh, no, I had a variety of jobs. When I first left school, I worked on the pit heap, as we described it then, that's the surface of the mines.
Mm-hmm.
After about 6 months, my pals were all down the mine, so I went down the mine too. Pony driving.
This was where? In
this was in Durham, mm-hmm. at what they call the Hazard Colliery.
Mm-hmm.
And I got out of there. I took a job in the Cooperative Society as an apprentice grocer. Then the wage wasn't very much and we had a large family. So I went as an apprentice wagon wright. I stayed there from the age of 16 until almost 22. And then we'd had a succession of strikes. There was a 13-week strike, a 6-week strike, 21 weeks, and then finally the big strike in 1926, the general strike, when you'll probably remember the transport services, the miners, the railwaymen, everybody was involved at that time. And after being out of work for almost 7 months, when I was not closely involved, it was simply because I was working as a wagon wright on the pit surface, you see, supplying wagons for the coal industry. And I decided I had sufficient of this strike business. There was no security at all. And what I wanted above everything else was security.
Mm.
So I learned of a man quite near to us who had obtained a job in a mental hospital in the Midlands. I went up to his parents and got the address, which was Barnsley Hall, Bromsgrove in Worcestershire. And I wrote for a job. I was invited down, and almost without a lengthy interview or anything like that, the medical superintendent, Dr. Percy Theodore Hughes, congratulated me on my application form and the writing and all that sort of thing. My background and sports activities, singing, and I was engaged. And that was a tremendous relief to me, because at that time I knew the family were, to all intents and purposes, starving.
Your own family?
Up in Durham, yes. Mm-hmm. And the shops at that time, I'd given all the customers the credit as long as they could. Then of course they hadn't any stocks coming in, they weren't getting any money in. They had to board the shops up, the shop windows. A terrible time up in Durham. I was glad to get out of it.
Mm.
I was getting at that time 23 and 5 pence a week for working 66 hours.
This is in the mental hospital?
Yes, in Barnsley Hall, Bromsgrove.
Mm.
And I used to send £1 a week home out of this. And once a month, superannuation was deducted, and we had some coppers over 17 shillings. And I used to save the odd shillings from the other weeks to make up the straight pound. Because I realised that they were having a much rougher time than I was having. I was having good food, and it was really marvellous to me to be able to get out of it and have this feeling of security. That was more important than anything else. Well, at that time there was no union at Barnsley Hall, although previous to my coming to the hospital, Mr. W.C. Windsor had been president of the union, and I could never understand why the branch had been allowed to fall out in that way. But because of the general strike, there was the biggest influx of recruitment into the mental hospital service, or asylums as they called them in those days, that ever there had been. And there was quite a few chaps from the north, and particularly from Durham, who had been recruited at that time. And we got together and formed a branch of the union. I joined the service in November 1926, and we got the branch going in November 1927. So it was hard work recruiting members, because they were so afraid of victimization in those days. And in the first 6 months of the branch being formed, there were two secretaries dismissed from the service.
Over what reasons?
Well, one, it was because of his association with, he was a married man, and because he'd been associated with a member of the female staff. And I don't know the reason for the other one now, I can't recall it. But anyway, they used any pretext. And the man who was doing the job before me, we used to meet, pass resolutions, and make applications for certain improvements in the service. And each time when we came to a meeting, this secretary said, "I haven't had a reply. I'm still waiting for a reply." This sort of thing kept on, till eventually we got rather upset about it. We felt that we were working and just at a dead end. And he admitted eventually that he hadn't written these applications at all. He was afraid to write, you see. So we had to find another secretary, and we went round, as several were proposed at this meeting in the Forest Hotel at Lickey End, Bromsgrove, and couldn't get anyone to take the job. And somebody proposed me, and I said, "Well, I haven't had any experience of this work at all." I was only 22 at that time. "But I'll have a shot at it, because I don't want to see the branch fall away." And that was the start of my 22 and a half years as branch secretary. During that time, I attended meetings of what was then the Midland Federation, and Walter Blood was the secretary of the federation. And gradually, I became a member of the National Executive Committee, and I met George Gibson and all the old timers, Mr. Yearsley, who was then the accountant, the grandfather of Mr. Yearsley, which is now associated with the union. And I really enjoyed the work, even though we hadn't very much encouragement. There were times when I negotiated settlements locally without any help from head office. In fact, the biggest increase that was ever obtained for the staff at Barnsley Hall, I got it through negotiation with the visiting committee, as it was then called.
How did you get? How did you get access to the visiting committee? Did you go to them directly?
Oh yes, you had to apply for an interview. And I well remember, on this occasion, market, we had been accustomed to increases of either sixpence a week or a decrease of sixpence per week in accordance with the fluctuations in the cost of living. And The staff were naturally dissatisfied with the pay that they were receiving at that time, because the place was administered by the county council. And we had a meeting. There were various propositions put forward. It was like an auction, you know. We had people saying, I move that we put in for an increase of 10 shillings a week. Somebody else would say, I move that we have an increase of £1 a week. May as well go the whole hog. And I said, now, to make any impression at all, it's best to be realistic and to be able to prove what you're applying for is justified. And I proposed that we put in for 12 and sixpence a week. I said, it's no use these big figures, you know, splitting it up by the 10 bob or a pound, that sort of thing. You've got to make it something that'll really prove that your claim is justified. So I put forward a statement when I interviewed the visiting committee, saying that this is typical of the experience of our staff. I am a married man with two children, and this is my outlay for the week. And I set out in detail everything that we had recorded at home for the week. And at the end of it, I could not quite pay my way. And I said to the visiting committee, this is the first situation in my life when I've been unable to meet my commitments. And of course, that did make an impression. And afterwards, one member of the visiting committee asked me if he could borrow this statement of mine and see if he'd like to take it and consider it. I said, certainly. Gave it to him. And he came up to see me a week afterwards and he said, my wife pointed out that you haven't put anything in this list for footwear for yourself, your wife and your two children. I said, no, because in this particular week we hadn't had any outlay. And in order to cut down costs of shoe repairing or purchasing, I do my own shoe repairs. Anyway, we got the 12 and sixpence to the astonishment of everyone. We got it exactly.
Did the union have recognition, formal recognition, before that time? Or I mean, did you have problems getting the union recognised as such, as you, as someone that they would be prepared to talk to?
No, we had some difficulty in getting recognition in the first place. But after we became established, we had George Gibson down, and that was a big occasion in our history, of course, the General Secretary coming. And I persuaded the medical superintendent, Dr. Hughes, to take the chair on that occasion.
Oh,
and of course, this gave us a great boost.
But was it, who was, in terms of, you said you had some trouble over recognition, what was the problem? Was it with the medical superintendent or the visiting committee or both?
I think it was mainly the chairman of the visiting committee, who was a magistrate and an elderly man who would be around the 80 mark at that time, called Frank Smith. And I well remember on one occasion we had Herbert Shaw down, he was Assistant General Secretary then, to try and improve our conditions. I forget whether it was an increase in pay or a reduction of hours we were after. It was an increase in pay, I'm pretty certain. But I can remember the chairman, Frank Smith, saying after Herbert Shaw had made his opening statement, well, this isn't a laborious job, you know. He says, you don't find the same sort of activity that you would get from a navvy, for instance. You know, this was absolutely shocking.
So he thought it was an easy job?
He thought it was an easy job because there was very little manual work attached to it. But if he'd seen what we were doing as student nurses, every morning we had to get down on our hands and knees and wax scrub the floor in the dormitory and the dining room and what was then the day room. And this was really hard work. And after we'd scrubbed it and waxed it, we had to polish it. And this was the sort of training that we had in those days. And I've even known when I and others have been stripped to the waist on ladders and planks, scrubbing the dormitory walls. Work which nurses nowadays, of course, they wouldn't think of them. Allow it to be done.
Did you have the patience to help you in those kinds of jobs, or were you...
Not in those particular jobs. Sometimes the patients used to help us with the floor polishing.
And the outdoor staff used to do it. Wasn't the outdoor staff...
No, it was all the... mostly the resident staff in those days. And by the way, the resident staff, to qualify for non-residency, they had to have 5 years' service and have passed their final examination before they could apply for permission to marry and live out. And in some hospitals it was even worse than Barnsley Hall. I well remember being told that at Rubery they had to wait for a vacancy on the non-resident staff, and there were men there, married men with families, with 17 years service waiting to become non-resident.
Now I want to ask you, do you take mustard?
Mustard?
On your sandwiches.
Oh yes, please. Lovely. Thank you very much. Yes, we're carrying on. Sorry, but where were we? Yes, about, so that in fact there was very strict rules about those that were allowed to live out.
Oh yes. You see, the main purpose was to preserve a certain number of staff resident and in rooms on the wards. Actually on the wards.
You used to sleep in the
wards? Oh yes. And you were available in case of any trouble at any time during the night, you see.
Was it common to get called out for trouble, or...?
Not common, I wouldn't say that. At about... maybe once a week. But it depended, of course, upon the conditions.
This would be a violent patient or something?
That's it.
Something like...
Yes. Of course, as a member of the staff on his own in the ward, he was always liable to be attacked.
What kind of protection did you... Did any of the other patients protect you if you were attacked, or... Could you rely on a strong patient or something?
No. The patients usually just accepted it,
But there was always this risk of...
Yes. Yes. They had to have a certain number of staff available during the night, and even after we'd become non-resident, there was a rota arrangement where you had to come and sleep in occasionally, maybe once a week, and you had to sleep in on the ward and be ready for an emergency.
And this was resented very much, was it, by the...
Well, I wouldn't say it was strongly resented. There was nothing you could do about it because it was put to you that you must have a certain number of staff available. And you felt it was impossible to improve that particular situation. All you could hope for was gradually to have sufficient recruits to reduce this number of non-resident staff having to come in.
to have a proper cover on night.
Yes.
And yes, the question I was going to ask now is about the membership of the union. About
yes.
Was it equal numbers of men and women, or were the women more reluctant?
No, there were very few women in those early days, and after we'd been functioning about 2 years or so, we'd got the majority of the male staff in, and there was only two members of the male staff who refused to join the union.
Mm. What reasons did they give? Did they give any reason?
They couldn't give any reason other than that they were opposed to it and probably afraid of victimisation. I don't know. But anyway, at one time we discussed this at a union meeting, and it was decided to send them to Coventry.
Mm.
And for a time there's no members of the staff would speak to them except when it was absolutely necessary in the performance of their duties.
Mm. But the women were much...
The women somehow, they weren't interested in trade unionism.
Mm.
You see, it was something completely foreign to them.
Mm.
Anything approaching trade unionism, it was thought of in the nature of what was then called Bolshevism.
So it was, it was a bit of snobbishness, do you think, or
not entirely snobbishness, it was just something strange that they were not prepared at that time to accept.
Mm.
I couldn't see much purpose in it, but after a time we did recruit a few of them, and we were able to help some of them when they were in difficulties.
Mm.
And eventually we developed quite a strong membership.
Oh.
You know, I encouraged them by getting recruitment badges for them.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I can show you some of the badges. The TUC used to give a badge for recruiting, I think it was 25 members.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a few of our staff, they got these badges and they were proud to wear them. We had some difficulty one time about the wearing of the union badge.
Mm-hmm.
And the matron, she said she was not going to allow her staff to wear the union badge on duty. And we took this up as a big issue, and I pointed out that it had been taken to the courts, and the judgment had been in our favour.
Mm.
So,
what reason did she give?
Nothing, just that she was opposed to the union, of course. She felt it was undermining her position.
Yes.
And she didn't want any interference.
Mm.
Anyway, we managed to get that settled satisfactorily.
Mm.
And lots of other things. Later on in my service at the hospital, we were the first hospital in the country to introduce joint staff consultation.
Mm.
And we set up a joint staff consultative committee, and I was joint chairman with the medical superintendent. And we used to take it in turns to chair the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And this brought us into closer contact with the chief male nurse, as he was then called, and the matron. And if there was any issue which involved them, and this was very often, of course, I would send for them and put the point to them.
But before that, you didn't really have the close contact with them?
Oh, no. No, no. There was one time when George Gibson was coming down to a meeting, and the junior doctor was doing his rounds, and he was due to hold a lecture for student nurses on the same evening that we'd arranged for George Gibson to come. So when he came into the ward, I asked him if he would kindly postpone his meeting so that the staff could all attend this union meeting. He said he would think it over, and he left the ward. A few minutes later, the telephone rang. The chief mill nurse wanted me in his office. So I went up there, and there was just he and I present. And he absolutely hammered me. He said, "You are going over my head," he says. "You're not going to run this hospital." And he said, "If I have any more of it," he says, "you'll have 20 minutes notice. You'll be down the drive." And well, of course, there was just he and I present, and I hadn't any witness to this. But I couldn't do anything about it. But that was the sort of attitude that they adopted in those days.
Did they ever try to victimise you, or hold back your career in any way because of your union activity?
I don't think so, because after a while it was accepted, and I was extremely careful. I had one issue when a patient who was a melancholy type, and he inflicted very grave injuries upon himself. At one time he pulled out an eye with his fingers, and after that he had to wear boxing gloves with the thumb of the glove stitched into the palm of the hand so that he couldn't injure himself with the thumb. He went to the toilet one day, and he had to be under supervision at all times. There was one nurse on him and another patient who was also addicted to self-injury.
There were special, weren't there? And you had to fill in cards.
You had to fill in a book stating the time that you took over and the time that the next man took over from you. On one occasion, this patient went to the lavatory, and while he was in the lavatory, he pulled out one of his testicles, and late a man was dismissed from the service for that 20 minutes notice. On another occasion, during the night, he managed to get a glove off, and he pulled out the other eye. And the man was dismissed for that. And because of this eye injury, we sent for the surgeon, Dr. Coker of Bromsgrove, and he came up and attended to the eye, and one of the staff was required to help him. And the charge nurse chose me, so I stayed with him about half, I think it was a quarter of an hour, beyond the normal duty time. And afterwards, I approached the deputy chief mill nurse to have this quarter of an hour repaid to me in time. And he took exception to this. He said, "Nonsense," he said, you won't get it." He said, "You had time off some months ago because of your daughter having scarlet fever." I said, "Well, that was none of my choice." But he says, "However, if you persist in it," he says, "you can go before the medical superintendent." I said, "All right, I'll do that." And I went before the medical superintendent, and after we discussed this, he said to this officer, "Is there any question about Nurse Waits having done this extra duty? Did he actually do it?" He said, "Yes." And he said, he turned to me, he says, "I'm inclined to regard it that you look upon this as a question of principle rather than the actual time." I said, that is so. I says, "I've got to be extremely careful to see that I don't do anything which I wouldn't expect any other member to do." And he said, "All right," he said, "you shall have this quarter of an hour." All this fuss about nothing. And I was giving up time continually went off duty to do various things, playing in the band, playing football or cricket, you know.
What music instrument did you play?
The drums.
Oh. Did you play the drums before you came into this?
No.
Or so
no.
You learned while you were
I
there?
I learned there. We had a good orchestra. Yes, I was a trained singer. I took my training while I was at Barnsley Hall. And because of being a chorister in the church choir at the hall, and interested in music, of course, always. I got this job as a drummer and I picked it up fairly quickly.
And what kinds of occasions would the band play at?
Mostly for patients' dances, and a monthly dance for staff. And we also played for the pictures at that time, silent films, of course.
Did you?
Yes.
Oh. And I mean, what kinds of other social activities used to go on in the hospitals at those times?
The only social activity, apart from the cinema, the church, if you can describe it as such, was a smoking concert which we held for male patients.
A smoking concert?
A smoking concert in the visiting room. I think that was about once a fortnight.
A smoking concert being when we were allowed to smoke?
Oh yes, the patients were allowed to smoke.
Oh, so
it was for the patients, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh. Oh yes, it was very good too. We had a patient with a very good voice called Mr. W.H.M. Bohr of Wolverhampton. He had been employed by the Chubb Lock Company and he got a beautiful bass voice. He used to sing the floral dance and all those old bass songs, Friend of Mine, Shipmates of Mine. And at that time I was a baritone, but I used to take the tenor in duets with him. The Battle Eve, Excelsior and all that sort of thing, you know. And we used to thoroughly enjoy it. A nice break from the normal duty routine.
I suppose, in fact, you were, I mean, with the patients staying so long in hospital, you got to know them very closely, is that?
Oh, yes, yes. And it wasn't all depressing, you know. We had relief. We had patients who were naturally humorous. And they used to make us laugh occasionally.
So we were talking about how some of the patients were quite characters.
Yes.
And
well, there was one patient quite outstanding. His name was John Curran, and his father had had a tailor's business in Yorkshire, and he used to cause quite a lot of amusement. He used to joke about various things, and his outstanding feature was a laugh which I've never heard before or since. And when there was a concert came, we used to engage concert parties occasionally to entertain the patients. And as a concert came, Curran, a private patient incidentally, GPI, and he used to come out with a laugh, something like this, ha 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 ha, like that. And nobody had ever come out with anything approaching that before. And it used to cause general laughter. But the patients used to play draughts and various other games, dominoes and wards as well.
Was there much difference between the way the private patients and what was the
No, very little difference. The private patients were allowed to wear their own clothes and they had slightly better food. They had puddings in addition to their normal meal, main meal.
Did they have separate accommodation? Or
no.
So they?
No, they were treated just the same as the other patients as far as accommodation goes.
So they just slept in on the wards?
Oh, yeah.
And
yes.
So what was the advantage really of being a private patient? Well, just wearing clothes?
Very little. Probably the same thing that actuates people to become private patients these days. They have the money and they can afford it and that's it. But any great difference just didn't exist.
And the staff didn't sort of treat them any different, did they?
Oh, no.
They didn't say?
No. Mister, we had to call them all Mister.
Oh, so they had to be addressed as Mister?
Yes.
Well, how would the other patients be addressed as?
Nothing. George or...
Oh, Christian names.
Yeah, very often, yes, well. You were with them day after day for years. We had patients in our ward that had been there for 23 years and longer.
So the age of, so that you didn't address these patients by their Christian name, they were always just called Mr.
Yes.
Oh, that's
yes.
Interesting. Did they engage in the kinds of, they have to work, like some of the patients had to work, didn't they? I mean, what?
Yes. We had patients regularly employed out on the farm. The farm was in the hospital grounds, you know. Yeah.
Did you used to go out or did you used to stay on the
ward? No, I and the other nurses didn't normally go out. We had one elderly staff nurse who hadn't passed any examinations or anything like that. And he wasn't very bright. And he was given the job of supervising the patients who were working on the farm and gardens. Quite big gardens too.
Yeah.
The produce was used, of course, mainly for the hospital.
Mm. What kinds of treatments used to be common for patients?
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that. There was certain treatments in the early days which upset me very much. For example, patients suffering from GPI, that is general paralysis of the insane, which usually came from contracting syphilis. There was a treatment introduced to induce malaria. And I can remember the doctor coming to the ward with mosquitoes in a glass tube which had been previously infected with malaria. And they were put on the surface of the patient's skin and allowed to bite it and cause malaria to develop.
On their arm, this would be?
I can't recall whether it was on the arm. I think it was the arm. This caused the temperature to soar, and I can remember taking temperatures of 106.6 or 8. Now that's much beyond the normal maximum when the case is virtually hopeless, you know, in ordinary circumstances, but malaria. It was a special condition which allowed the temperature to go, and then after a while it was reduced. And this was
tepid sponging and things.
And this was supposed to help the patient or to stop the disease, general paralysis, from developing further. Another thing was before they gave the electric shock treatment, they gave an injection into the arm, into the bloodstream, and then after this injection had been given, they released the tourniquet and you counted 9, and then the patient had an epileptic fit. And this, the first time I saw it, it absolutely horrified me. And then later we had the electroconvulsive therapy, where you would touch the pulse of the patient's head. And in the early days, the reactions were so severe that fractures were reported because of this. You know, when the treatment had been given, the patient had such a tremendous convulsion.
Because they didn't give muscle relaxants?
No, that was not brought in until later.
Yeah.
That again, it seemed to me to be quite wrong, although I can recall cases, one in particular, where a patient who was rather depressed, and he would go for periods refusing to take any food. And the doctor would feed him nasally for a time. And then when this treatment came in, we would give him this shock treatment. And afterwards, when he recovered, he would resume taking his food. That's about the only occasion when I can recall it having had beneficial effects. But one treatment which I felt very strongly against was prefrontal leucotomy. And as you probably know, they bored two holes in the forehead and they severed one part of the brain from the other. And this was supposed to quieten patients that were aggressive and violent. But I always felt that to interfere with the functioning of the brain, to sever part of the brain from the other, it was something which once done could never be brought back. I think it was the Americans that introduced this during the Second War. I know the American surgeons used to do these operations.
Did they?
First, I believe, yes. Because we had an emergency hospital next to Barnsley Hall, quite close, a Huttert hospital, and the Americans had taken this over.
Did the malarial therapy used to work at all, or was it really just experimenting and...
I think it was largely experimental, but it appeared to have some beneficial effect. It just stopped the disease from progressing, because at one time it was fatal, you know.
Yes, the syphilis.
Yes.
But I imagine it must have been quite risky, and the malarial therapy must have been quite risky. I imagine some of the patients died, did they, or...?
No, I can't recall any patient dying from it.
No.
We usually managed to bring them round after they'd had this extreme temperature.
But they'd be very ill for quite a while, wouldn't they?
I can't recall them being ill for any considerable time, no. They seemed to shake it off.
But it was a period when they were starting to experiment with new treatments, wasn't it? They were looking around for physical treatments.
Yes. There was another treatment given, which was prolonged sleep. And you had to inject, the nurses used to do these injections, by the way, in this particular instance. And the juice of the stuff we used to put in now. It caused the patient to sleep for days on end. The only time that they were roused was when we had to give them food. We used to rouse them and feed them and then they'd go off to sleep again. I think the injections were given twice a day.
And did this seem to do it to help, or...?
It's problematical, I don't know. Can't remember any outstanding success.
What were the normal kinds of treatments available? I suppose they weren't the kinds of drugs that around now. I mean, that obviously made a...
No, largely it was sedatives.
Yes. But on the whole, patients' symptoms weren't probably as controlled as they are now, is that right?
Oh, nothing like it. Epileptic attacks were very frequent, of course. Mm. And paraldehyde. I used to give that. Patients who were sleepless. But I forget what the name of the drug was that they used to give.
Would it be insulin?
Insulin treatment, yes.
That would be where they
insulin
would
be shock treatment,
yes.
That was.
Yes.
And we made a succession of injections until it induced a state of shock when the patient was almost comatose, perspiring, cold perspiring.